Hi, and welcome to episode 96 of the Studio Insider Art Podcast. Today's episode is a real treat for all the art supply nerds out there. Stephen Patterson is the CEO of Derivan, a family-owned Sydney-based company that manufactures one of my favourite brand of acrylic paints, Derivan Matisse. Many of the Aussie artists out there would likely have used a Derivan product at one time or another, as they were the first company to manufacture student-grade acrylics back in the 1950s when his father started the company with a couple of partners. Stephen grew up at the factory and started off working in the lab in the day and studying chemistry at night. He's a multi-passionate creative and innovative CEO that has been involved with the creation of a number of unique products, many of which have been inspired by the requests coming from artists. He also continues to strive to make the factory and the products he makes as environmentally friendly as possible. I really hope you enjoy learning more about this unique paint company and the man behind it. I'm Suze Nethercutt, and this is the Studio Insider Art Podcast, where I open up about what it's really like to be a professional artist. Whether I'm having chats with my studio bestie Steph, interviewing inspiring creatives, or answering listener questions, there's something here for every established and emerging artist. My mission is that my journey will help you feel a bit more at home in your own. Thanks so much for joining me today, Stephen, on the podcast. I'm a huge fan of Matisse and Derivan paints and products, and I've been using them for a couple of decades, so it's a thrill to have you on.
Suze, thank you very much for having me on, and that's really nice to hear that you've been using the products for so long.
Yes, yeah, they're a bit of an institution.
Yeah, which is nice to hear.
Ah, lovely. Hey, look, I know that you started off working in the Derivan lab in 1983, so it's been a while. You studied chemistry at night and learnt to make paint during the day. I wonder if you could start off by telling our listeners a bit about your journey to becoming a paint maker and the CEO of Derivan.
Yeah, so it's a family business and I'm one of the family members, so it's kind of a bit like Hotel California. You can check out, but you can never leave.
All right.
I've been in the business since the early 80s. I started in the lab, which is still one of my favorite places to be, and I still get to do a little bit of that, not as much as I'd like. But the business was started by my father in the late 50s with a couple of his mates, and it was in answer to a lack of paint for school kids, basically.
Right.
And so there was nothing really around. There was watercolors and there was oils, but there wasn't anything that was really suitable to teach kids art with. And that's where we started. So, yeah, basically the business sort of chose me.
Right.
Rather than me choosing.
You're born into it.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating. So, I'm really curious to know, how long had acrylic paints been around before the 1950s? They would have been pretty new by then, wouldn't they?
They were very new, absolutely, yeah. So that's kind of where the business, it started, because water-based emulsions and acrylics really only hit their strides or became commercially available in the early to mid-50s. And that, that was another thing that helped the business along, because it was kind of new technology at the time as well, yeah.
That's so interesting. So were you really fascinated by that particular medium and all the colour play? Did you grow up playing with the paints in the factory? How did that sort of scenario play out?
I literally did. All my friends went away for holidays and I got to work in a hot factory over the summer holidays.
Right.
Packing tubes and that sort of thing. And I was always going to go into the business. There was other things that I sort of thought about, but really I think the whole rounded thing of manufacturing, of getting to play with machines, of, trying to develop new processes within the manufacturing, and then, of course, new formulations and new colours, which I think is probably one of the most the main things that inspires me is new colours. Yeah, so it's
beautiful.
Yeah, it's great.
That's so exciting. I love hearing that you were down there on the floor all those years ago and that you've kind of grown up with it in your blood in a way.
Yeah, I still spend time out there. It's
I can see it behind you. I mean, we're on a video call and I can see the factory through your window. So you're obviously like still in knee deep in the factory and the preparation of the paints. And just for our listeners, you're in Sydney. That's right, isn't it?
That's correct. We're in Rhodes in Sydney and have been in Sydney our whole lives. We've moved a couple of times. We seem to spend about 20 years in each place. Yeah, but we're just down here at Rhodes, Western Sydney, I guess. Yeah.
Awesome. Hey, look, I know that Derevan's been around since the 60s and has had a vision of providing artists with environmentally and socially responsible paint while maintaining quality and a personal touch. Can you share with us a bit more about ways in which the company has innovated to make your products safer for the planet?
Yeah, sure. I grew up, I remember as a tiny kid, with my parents telling me to turn the lights off when you leave a room and not wasting anything. And I think that had been, you know, it was way before it was trendy to be environmentally conscious. I think it was more dad just didn't want to pay higher electricity bills.
Yeah, okay.
in all seriousness, though, it was... I remember as well as a kid, one day I think my brother and I were smashing something up. You know, it was an obsolete, I can't even remember what it was. I think it was just a box, or a wooden box. And there was no use for it. But Dad said, you know, someone spent time making that. And even though it was going to be thrown out, it was kind of like, don't destroy something, don't waste something, don't waste resources. And that's really something that I grew up with, that the company culture has embraced. So, you know, it's kind of there. It's always been there. And as far as products and our processes, it's been something that we've been trying to do. You know, it's always there in reducing. So over the years, we've been part of several different programs, be that with the local council. There was another program called Bin Trim. And quite often we don't have a whole lot to reduce in our waste or in our processes because we've already, you know, back in the bad old days when you needed to cool a machine, you kind of just plugged it into the tap and ran the water and just the water just ran down the drain. We haven't done that for more than a quarter of a century. You know, we started by just using a tank pump from a fridge and it cooled down enough. We've since got chillers and things in, but there's a whole lot of processes that we've found that you don't need to use energy, for instance, or you can save energy, which is just a good thing. And it's something that we've literally practiced as long as I remember.
Yeah, decades. It's interesting, isn't it? I think probably part of that post-World War II culture, isn't it? And I know that with my grandparents and my parents, there was always that emphasis on appreciate what you have and don't destroy the things around you and reuse and recycle. And it's, you know, that philosophy has been there and I grew up with that as well. And it's just wonderful to see that that's been maintained through the whole life of the company and that those values have been held true. And it's not just like you've got on a greenwashing bandwagon. It's actually, you know, a core part of the culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you've hit the nail on the head. It probably has come from, the older generations that maybe didn't have as much and just appreciating what you've got. And finding other ways, something that just struck me was we had a guy, and when we first moved into this factory about 12 years ago, a chap came in and wanted to sell us a dehumidifier for the air. We use a lot of compressed air for the various different machines. And we found, and I thought, well, we've never had one. Why do we need one now? And it turned out purely that where the air compressors were, that the water, it just was a very tall pipe that went up onto the roof and then came back down to the machines. So we actually had some pipe that we'd taken from the old factory that was knocked down and we put it up, you know, so it wasn't being used anyway. We put it up and thought, we'll give this a try rather than having a machine that's got to run all the time. And lo and behold, it actually worked. So we don't need a dehumidifier.
That's
cool.
Awesome. That's the Australian way, right? Just get in there and find something that does the job. I love that.
Exactly.
That's such a great story.
It's nothing to do with being cheap.
No, I understand. And I just love that value has carried through the company for all of those years. It's so holistically bound in. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And I know that you've done things fairly recently, like when I ordered some of the bigger quantities of paint recently, they came in the collapsible bags rather than the big plastic containers. Can you talk a little bit about those sorts of innovations?
Yeah. So a few years ago, we had graphic artists that had worked for us and had then joined the Department of Education up in Queensland. And we had a chance to sponsor a survey. And in that, we got to ask some questions. And one thing that we'd really wondered was, because we'd moved a whole of our containers to PET, which made them more readily recyclable, mm-hmm. but we just wondered how many people actually did really recycle those containers. And it came back, it was quite a broad survey, only in Queensland though, but I don't recall the number of schools, but it was several hundred, and only about 7%, and this was in an environmental survey, so you mm-hmm. kind of think that definitely be, you know, probably the upper end of the number, mm-hmm. and it was 7%, 7% mm. said that they recycled things. So we thought, so we've got to do something better. So with the, it's not so new, the packaging now, but exactly as you say, with the collapsible eco packs, it uses less than 30% plastic, knowing that most of that plastic will unfortunately probably go to to landfill rather than actually be recycled. So that was the idea behind that. But, you know, we're constantly looking at our packaging, and we're actually looking at our packaging again for the tubes right at the moment, where we went from cardboard to plastic because it worked better, and PET, and it's all recyclable and all that sort of good stuff. However, now with plastics, obviously not everything makes it back. We've got a program where retailers, or anyone for that matter, can send that packaging back
can
to
they?
Us. Yeah, it's on our website.
Right.
There's a reply page.
Fantastic. I didn't know that. And we'll link to that because I think there'll be a lot of artists out there that would make the effort to do that.
Yeah, cool. But it's still plastic. So, and this is the clams, for instance, that the tubes come in, and there's the potential that if they don't get recycled, those, you know, nanoparticles of plastic will end up in waterways. So we're now starting to see how we go back to cardboard. So, you know, some of these things go in a full circle sort of
thing. I had no idea that they used to be in cardboard, actually. How do you do that? Is it kind of like a milk carton type situation?
Oh, no, so this is tubes. This is the
right.
what you call the inner packaging. Yeah.
Yes,
no,
gotcha.
We're still looking. I wish I could find something. You know, we're still looking for a biodegradable container, but it's not really practical when we've had in the past where artists have come in that have been using our paint for years and just brought the stuff back in, you know, to show us. And we'd bring jars back in that are over 30 years old, and the paint's still good.
Wow.
They've kept it. So, you know, a biodegradable container is really not going to work in that sort of situation.
Yeah, absolutely. But I just love that you're continually making that effort to make sure you're doing the best you can. I mean, I know it's something that as an artist I think about a lot with every part of my process, how much of it is okay for the environment. So that's a brilliant tip to know that we can send the packaging back to you guys and you will recycle it, because it can be a bit confusing to know what to do with a paint tube. Like, I'm not sure, it's got paint on the inside. And so good on you guys. That's such a great initiative, and great to hear that you're always seeking ways to improve and take care of the planet.
Yeah, cool.
Hey, Derevan has created a number of world-first products, such as non-toxic screen inks and face and body paint. And I believe more recently you've won awards for your liquid pencil products. Can you tell us a bit more about what inspires Derevan's innovation, as it seems to play a pretty big role in your company and the products you create?
Yeah, I think the two big things here, you know, being environmentally and socially conscious, being aware of our surroundings and what we use and all that sort of thing is one major thing that drives us, and all of the things that wrap up in that, you know, not just the environment, but the social environment, our staff, their families, all that sort of thing. And next to that is what we do, what we actually make. And trying to provide, you know, the best products we can for the best money, and then moving beyond that to answering questions or fixing problems. So, you know, when an artist wants something, we want to be able to give them an answer on how to get to that. Now, whether that's a new product or whether it's a combination of different products that we already make, using products in different ways. So really, you know, the two main things are staying abreast of technology, any new things that happen to come out, new colors, new pigments, new emulsions, something along those lines, and then listening to artists and finding out, you know, things that they might dream up. I mean, they're on the cutting edge. They're the guys that are going to let us know when something isn't working for them, or it's probably more than that. It's more when they want to do something and they just can't find a way to do it. That's where we want to, you know, we want to be involved, because that stretches us and we learn more, and that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah, I can sense the passion when you speak behind, you know, that challenge when an artist throws out, you know, I wish there was something that could do this. Yeah. And I can almost see in your mind it's ticking away. Well, what could we create? What could we solve? It's a beautiful tradition actually in the history of art. I love that story of oil pastels, which were invented by Mr. Sennelier for Picasso, because he went into his art shop, which is still there in Paris, and said, I wish there was something that could do this. And he went away and created these beautiful, super soft, buttery pastels, which I love using over the top of my Derrida Matisse paints. And yeah, it's just, I love stories like that where, you know, the chemists get together with the artists and cook up these beautiful new products. What was the story behind the liquid pencil creation? Because that's a really unique product. It's like graphite in a tube, yeah?
Yeah, that's exactly it. It was probably a combination of two of those things. It was a combination of us finding the graphite when we found it was a new supply, I guess, or a new supply for us anyway, of the graphite. And the company actually normally supply, I don't know what you use graphite for. It's a mining industry and stuff like that.
I don't know either.
Lubrication. Yeah, it's mainly lubrication, I think. But we've got a very high quality grade that we use to in the liquid pencil. And it was kind of like, oh, this is cool. Now, what can we do with it? Mm. And we do that quite a lot, and then we find that it sits on the shelf. I recall, just as a slight aside, literally in the 80s, where we came up with this idea of scented paint, so visually impaired people could paint with it. So you had different colours.
Oh, what a great idea.
A great idea until you get to the point, unless it's a food stuff. Of course, the first thing that young kids want to do
when they smell
something, that's right. Now, you know, we make non-toxic paint and we make kids' colours, and so it's all quite safe, but it's not made as a food stuff.
No,
so you've got to be a bit careful.
Yeah, but I love the innovation that you had there in your head with that creation.
So, so sometimes things can get a little bit ahead of themselves. But with the liquid pencil, at the time we had a couple of artists that had actually asked for something, and that's probably what drove us to find it. You know, initially, it's just sometimes it can take some time to find a supplier of something, who wanted to do large areas of graphite, and they mainly worked with graphite pencils and graphite sticks and that sort of thing, but wanted to cover large areas.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, yeah, well, we got to be able to do that. And it took a while, and that's where that was developed. So it is fantastic for large areas, but, you know, once again, things tend to then go off on their tangents, and we'll see people using it more like a watercolor. Yeah, and on it goes. You sort of, that thing of, is it build it and they'll come. It's a similar thing that you might have designed, you know, in the lab we might have designed something to answer one question, but then find 5 years later it's being used for a ton of other things, which is, of course, fantastic.
And I guess with a company that, you know, has, you know, that many years of existence, like, you would really value that process of how it takes as long as it takes for the end product to reach the shelf. It could be in the lab for a decade before, you know, it's refined enough. And as you say, the paints have integrity and they last. And you've seen that proof in the products people have brought back to you.
Yeah, literally that. I mean, the testing that we do, it's not unusual. It would be unusual for something not to take at least 2 or 3 years to sort of get from go to woe. It can be many more years than that. A range of colours, which we might talk about in a tick, the Armenian colours, we had for, and actually the Mayan colours as well, we had them here for 8 years before the pigments to begin with, before we actually released them.
It's such good knowledge for artists to have, isn't it? Because it's pretty easy to walk into an art shop and spend a bomb, but what you're buying is years and years of research and, you know, and a product that has integrity. And as far as paints go, I mean, Derivan Matisse are pretty cost-effective anyway. So, yeah, but it's just good to understand the backstory of what goes into the creation of all these beautiful colours. And you guys, were you the first to produce screen inks that were non-toxic? Is that correct? What was the story?
Yeah, water-based. Water-based, that was a bit before my time, in the 70s. Well, I was around, but not, I wasn't here full-time. And in answer at the time to the, it's not a condescending term, but the rag trade, you know.
I was in the rag trade. I'm happy to call it the rag trade, so that's fine.
Which is the clothing industry,
we should tell people that the clothing industry, the nickname in Australia is the rag trade. No disrespect.
Exactly right. And a lot of screen printing done at the time, and they were all solvent-based inks. And we wanted to see screen printing in schools as well, as did quite a few teachers. And this is screen printing on fabric predominantly. And there just wasn't something. They all had white spirit, at the very least, white spirit in them. And a white spirit is a volatile solvent. And, you know, whilst maybe you teach some kids with it and they're exposed to it once or twice, in a year is no problem. Working with it all the time, without ventilation, working with it all the time, as a lot of the clothing industry places didn't have great ventilation, and just working with a volatile solvent all the time is really not healthy. So we set about trying to produce a completely water-based screening, and we did. And it's been around ever since and still used in education right across Australia, actually even overseas as well. I just got an order this morning from Singapore and they've ordered some. So it's, you know, it's things like that, being able to allow teachers to be able to do a process or teach a new method that really they weren't safely able to do prior to that.
Hey friends, just popping in to let you know that it's that time again, the Painting as a Practice free painting challenge that I run every February. I created this month-long painting challenge 2 years ago to help my community of artists to establish and nurture a regular painting practice, share the journey and cheer each other along. Since then, this challenge has helped thousands of artists worldwide and is absolutely free to join. I provide you with 28 prompts, one for each day of February 2022, but you can totally decide on how many days you'll paint. I, for example, will be painting on weekdays, but not weekends. I like to call it a soft challenge because I think we all need a bit of flexibility built into all challenges. I also have a free mini e-course called How to Paint as a Practice, that will help you learn all about how to create a successful art practice and make the most out of your challenge month. So if you'd like to join me and access all my freebies this February 2022, simply go to the challenge page on my website, susannethercottstudio.com/challenge, or simply click the link in the show notes. And if you'd like to really supercharge your art practice this February with my Painting as a Practice trilogy of e-courses, you can get 20% off all courses and bundles for the month of February by using the code FEB22 at the checkout. I'll see you there.
In the fashion industry as well, where I know, you know, I worked for a number of years. I had a clothing label for 15 years in Melbourne, so I understand what those factories are like, and I can picture exactly what would have gone on, you know, and they're not ventilated properly. And yeah, I can totally see the need. And I love that there's that continuity there with your product, because, you know, I was born in the 70s and I grew up using Derivan products through my schooling and younger years, and then I've graduated onto the Matisse range, which is the, you know, more premium range as I've become a professional artist. And I love that. I really love that there's that story that carries through, and that there's an Australian brand that I've had that exposure with my whole life. And it's just lovely to hear all these stories. Thanks for sharing with us.
That's awesome.
That's
good.
I'm a huge fan of your coloured gesso, actually. I think that is the most genius product. And I haven't actually seen, I don't even if any other companies are producing coloured gesso, but what inspired you to produce those?
Look, you know, much the same sort of thing. And you kind of look back in hindsight and you go, that was a bit of a no-brainer. It just had several people come to us asking for different coloured backgrounds, because what a lot of artists did prior to having this was, you know, they'd gesso their canvas and then paint it white, but then they wanted a blue or an orange or a whatever background. And so they then had to use, let's call it tube colour. And, so it's kind of an added colour. Also, if they wanted it to be that rich, matte, absorbent feel, you're not really getting that with tube colours. Mm. So it was actually in the 80s when we first developed these colours, and there's 40 colours. You're right. Many other colours make one or two, many other companies, I should say, of our competitors make one or two coloured gessos. They might make a black, which is very popular, or a couple of other colours, but that's it. They don't have the range that we have. And I'm still a bit surprised as why they don't. Let's keep that between you and me and your listeners.
And the rest of the thousands of people listening to this podcast. But you look, they're such a great product. I mean, I do very large, bright, colourful paintings, and it's been a game changer for me to be able to get in there on those backgrounds. And also because they're a bit less expensive, they're ones I can let my kids have a bit of a splash around and they can be really generous with, and I don't have to worry, you know, and they're just fantastic. Yeah, that's such a great
innovation. They're made to be opaque. You know, at worst, you may have to put two coats down. But, I mean, obviously we won't get into the technical side of sort of transparent and opaque paints and all that sort of thing. But, yes, it means that you can block in large areas, and absolutely the kids can have a play with them as well. Toxic, obviously.
They're fantastic. Yeah, no, they're so great. And just, you know, I mean, it's when you're making large paintings, it's pretty easy to use a lot of paint. So for someone like me, it's been, you know, I really only discovered them probably about 5 years ago. And I was just like, what? This is fantastic.
Yeah,
so brilliant. Love them. And look, another product that I adore and I use all the time is your Australian Colours range, which are produced by the premium brand that you have, Matisse. Can you share with us a bit of the background on the inspiration to create this gorgeous set of colours? And do you have any new colours coming out that you'd like to share with us about?
Yeah, sure. So Australian Sienna was probably one of the first. And the story behind that, and I try not to take up too much of your time, but the story behind that was our raw Sienna at the time had I do the costings. And it had started to become quite expensive. You know, everyone else has their raw sienna in series one. So I took a bit of a look at it. And over the years, whilst we generally don't change the colours at all, sometimes they might change if the pigment, if the actual, either the manufacturer changes and we have to change pigments and the single pigment colours, or, you know, things do happen along the way where supply changes or that sort of thing. And also it did sell very well, you know, not too sure why. So you have a bit of a look at it and realize that whilst it was quite different to the standard raw sienna, it was this glorious, and still is, this glorious sienna color with an amazing glowing undertone, which most siennas don't have the same sort of golden undertone like that. And that kind of started us off. So we moved that and called it Australian Sienna. and made a more standard raw sienna, which we still make. And that did send us off. We're trying to work out what name do we call it? What do we do with it? And that sent us off on another path of, let's find some other colours that are like this. So Southern Ocean Blue, Australian Red.
Gorgeous. Yeah, Southern Ocean Blue. Love it.
Glorious colours.
Sorry, I'm happy to nerd out with you about this because I love them.
Yeah, I try not to talk about colours too much because I see people's eyes glaze over, but it is something that I do.
Well, you have a captive audience here because we're all artists and we're looking for the perfect colours. So
excellent, excellent. And that sort of led us on to now we have a range of colours from Armenia, which are all, they're not earth colours, there's a green and a blue in there, but they're all effectively dug up, they're not synthesised. We have the Mayan colours, which are totally synthesised. They were made a group at the University in Texas, anyway, in the US, did a project on going down that rabbit hole of trying to find out what the Mayans use, the actual chemical makeup. They recreated that, and we were lucky enough to buy some of the pigments before the company sort of started, produced these recreations, and then they disappeared again.
Oh, okay. You got in while the getting was good.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether we'll find them again, but we'll see how we go. And, of course, one of my favourite, the Yirrkala colours, which are from Arnhem Land. And, we literally got, after getting in contact with the community up there, they sent us down and we bought these rocks from them, as it turned out. Rocks the size of your fist, sort of the size of tennis balls. And when they arrived, all packaged up in Western Star butter boxes and all this sort of thing. It was like, oh, okay, what do we do with these now? Because we used to pigment. We don't normally have to grind things.
I might just drop in here, Stephen, for our American listeners, that Arnhem Land is up in the top centre of Australia and it's an Indigenous community of people. Yep.
And they're one of the last communities to actually still make their own paint. They do use some of ours as well, but they make up and have their own, their own ochres and still make their artwork from the paint that they make.
Yes.
In a traditional way. So we spent some time literally making a machine that would crush.
Wow, another rocks. Innovation.
Yeah, well, we had a little lab.
Necessity
crusher.
Is the mother invention.
It was. Yeah, seriously. And the boys had a ball doing that. And then we had to sieve it and wash it. And it was quite a process.
I can relate to that because I sometimes do forage little bits of pigment and make my own watercolour. And it's such a beautiful process. But I love hearing that you've done it, obviously, in partnership with an Indigenous community.
Yep. Definitely.
Fantastic.
Yes. Yeah. So, and there's more to come there.
Well, yes. So exciting. I think Eliza said, and that's one of your assistants there, that I should ask you about Yin Min.
Yin Min. Once again, it's that sort of thing. I, obviously, being a pigment nerd or a colour nerd, read strange and weird and wonderful different digests, and I read about this brand new blue. Now, there hasn't been a new blue pigment in around 200 years, and I thought, I found the chap's name and Google's wonderful with that sort of thing. So I emailed him and he emailed back and said, actually we're talking to this particular pigment manufacturer, but yes, we'll, to speak to them. Now they were actually one of our suppliers already. So we've made Yin Min. Now it gets its name from its ingredients, yttrium, indium and manganese. And the professor who developed it, they were actually trying to make electrical parts or some sort of semiconductor, I don't understand anything about that, and burnt the materials. They cooked it for too long. But ended up with this magnificent blue pigment. Mm. And Maz's wife, the professor, his wife is actually an artist, and so he was kind of tuned into, don't just throw that out and move on and think, oh, we made a mistake. Actually do something about it, which he did, which was fantastic. Mm. Now, I mean, one interesting thing about this pigment is that it reflects all, there's two things actually, reflects all IR radiation. And that, from an architectural perspective, would be fantastic because it means it has the potential, I think they've done some testing, of keeping a building's temperature, reducing it by somewhere between 3 and 5 degrees Celsius.
Oh, well, that's going to matter in the future of the world, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The other thing is, from our perspective as artists, it's a really cool mid-tone blue. It works really well to mix purples, but also, you know, heading the other way, mixing greens, you can get some quite bright greens out of it. So we don't really have a mid-tone blue, and that's it. The only problem is it's a bit expensive at the moment.
Yeah, right. But one day, series 6 or 7 out. Or something.
even more expensive than that.
Yeah, okay.
It's $2,000 a kilo.
Wow.
Is the pigment cost. Yeah.
Yes, fair enough. But, yeah, fascinating story, a true Louis Pasteur moment, isn't it?
Yeah,
fascinating. I love it. Now, look, you're very creative, obviously, in creating all these beautiful new paints and mediums and things. Can you share with us a bit more about your own creative leanings and passions?
I'm probably jack of all trades. It might be easier to explain in music terms. No one will listen to my playlists because, you know, I can have anything from Johnny Cash followed by Chopin followed by Enya, one song after the other. The reason I'm actually a little bit hoarse today is because I just on the side playing a rockabilly band.
Oh, nice.
Gig last night, which was a lot of fun, but I'm a little bit hoarse this morning. But I also play in a pipe band as well. I play the drums
awesome.
In a bagpipe band. So they're two kind of different, very different genres.
Yes.
And when it comes to artwork, it's a similar thing. So although I read an article recently that said it's changing, but, you know, basically at art school you had to pick your genre and run with it. I haven't done that, so I'm obviously never going to get anywhere because I get into printmaking, I get into painting and in various different formats. I've taught painting, I've taught painted finishes. I love painted finishes, you know, marbling and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I'm all over the shop.
I think that's kind of perfect. That's kind of perfect for what you do because, if you've got a hand in a lot of different things, you know, that only can enhance your ability to make the right products and be actually in the mind of the artist, which as a, a CEO of a company, I imagine that is actually quite rare to have someone that's so on the ground and, up to their elbows in the physical reality of what they're creating and selling. And so it doesn't surprise me at all, actually. I think it's kind of perfect. I like your random playlist. And also, I agree with you, and I hope it is shifting a bit out there in the academic art world around this emphasis on, you've got to hone in on one style and known for one thing. And I've had a lot of conversations on the podcast about how actually when you look at the history of art, it's the artists that continually shift and change and push boundaries and do things that weren't done before and are very unacademic. They're the ones that are remembered, Let's not forget that it's, and for me personally, in my own practice, being able to follow those urges and whims is part of what I feel is the most precious thing about being an artist. So I think you're normal, actually.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes I do wonder because it may not necessarily be a financially viable thing, I love printmaking and intaglio printmaking. I think I also like a challenge. I'm sure I do. And so water-based inks and anything really to do with intaglio techniques, water-based inks just really tend not to cut it. I've been playing with them for years. I've made my own. And I think we're almost on the cusp of a development because you've got to kind of put the whole thing together to try and make a non-toxic water-based version. Once again, that could be used in schools rather than having to leave it to tertiary because there's acids and solvents and things involved. And hopefully in the next year we might have something. You know, it's got a whole lot of things. You've got to kind of pin them down. But yeah, from a financial perspective, I think if we're owned by a private equity company, that one would have been shelved a long time ago because I've spent a lot of time on it. But it's an interest. That sort of thing is not a business decision.
Yeah, well, not everything can be in creative industries, and we've got to do these things to keep our passion alive. And also, you just never know. You never know where the next big trend in the art market will be either. And, you know, it could be that you do that 10, 15 years of development and then suddenly it's a thing. So who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
I love that you have the freedom to do that, and that with, you know, the company being a family-owned business, that you can maintain that. And I think it's a beautiful thing. And I think a lot of artists will love hearing that. That's the spirit behind Derevan Matisse.
Cool.
Hey, look, I've been lucky enough to be on a panel of artists that have been testing some of your new products over the past few years. And recently I was asked to test out your new watercolor ground, which I love. Such a good product. Can you tell us a bit about the long and careful testing process that a product goes through before it reaches the art store shelves? You talked about it a bit, but you haven't talked about like how in conversation with artists you are and the panels and things that you run. Sure. Can you tell us a bit more about that part of the process so our listeners can really understand how well tested these things are?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, thank you for your input.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was really helpful.
My pleasure.
It's one of those things, and it will depend. If it's a new colour, it might just be a pretty standard testing procedure because, you know, that's already laid down. We know what we need to do. We need to test compatibility, shelf testing, accelerated testing, all that sort of stuff. So that's kind of pretty simple. It's interesting when you get to mediums, you know, you decide whether you want the colour or not and then off you go. Mm. But when you get to mediums and some of the other bits and pieces, you know, whether that's a whole new range of colours or definitely some of the mediums like the one that you looked at, the overarching thing is, oh, well, yes, there's it looks like there's a gap, you know, that's not being filled here, or someone's, and that's generally because someone's made us aware of it, like the watercolor ground. Mm. So, you know, I want to be able to paint on stuff that isn't just watercolor paper.
Exactly.
And it's kind of, okay, well, that makes sense. And then the process, there's a lot of consultation because the process is then just how absorbent, the colour, I think, you know, we would have discussed at the time. Mm. Does it want to be bright white? Does it want to be off-white? Does it want to be, and so on. And then the absorbency. And, of course, the different substrates, for instance, that particular medium, the different substrates that it's going to be painted on will also dictate just how absorbent it is afterwards. So should we be making two of them, one for absorbent surfaces and one for non-absorbent surfaces? It kind of just goes on. But you've got to ask all those questions, you know, to make sure you've got the best product at the end of the day.
Mm, and work with different artists that approach those mediums in different ways.
Because absolutely.
I know on the panel that I was on, there was just such a broad spectrum of artists that are using watercolour in completely different ways. And for me, I mean, I know there are other watercolour gessos out there. What are we calling it? A watercolour ground.
Yeah,
but watercolor. None that are like as cost effective as yours is. And what I wanted it for, I want to be able to paint watercolour on large canvases. So it was, and it was so exciting to use it. And then I got plied with questions. And I'm like, I can't tell you where I got it from. It's a secret. But
well, it's
now out.
It's not secret anymore. Yes, it's not secret anymore. Literally in the last few weeks. By all means, tell everybody.
Yeah, it's Derevan Watercolour Ground. Is that correct?
That's correct, Derevan Watercolour Ground, and you'll find it on our website.
We'll link to that. Yeah, in the show notes, everyone can pop over and check that out.
Yeah, so it's and finding exactly those sort of things that are niche, I guess we're talking in a pretty niche industry, but that do help people. And that's probably the biggest thing. And that's, you know, when we get feedback like that with people that just randomly email us and kind of say thank you, that's really nice. And I literally share that with everyone.
That's good to hear. Yes. No, well, I've been creating a watercolour e-course over the past few months and, you know, and the whole focus of it is non-traditional watercolour painting, which is, you know, I've been very much led by my own intuitive approach to art with the way that I use them. And so it's so exciting to be able to show people how they can actually paint on canvas and have a really accessible ground to use that they can just, I just used it on a canvas and it worked perfectly. It's a really, really good product. So thank you from me because it was enabled me to do something that I really wanted to do too.
Excellent. Excellent. No, that's brilliant.
Yay. And look, do you guys have anything else coming up that you'd like to share about? Anything exciting on the horizon?
Oh, Suze, there's so many things.
So
there's
many
just
things.
Not enough time. Look, I think coming up in the not too distant future, the next few months, we've got some CAD-free colours that we've actually been working on for a while. And what that means is we're matching as closely as we can to our cadmium colours.
Yeah, right.
Colours that don't have cadmium in them.
Oh, that's so good to hear because I'm a huge user of the cadmium orange. I love it, but I'm always like, oh, it's cadmium, be careful, it's a bit toxic. So,
yeah, in talking to the manufacturers over the years, they've always said that, or the ones we've used, they've been washed, acid washed, so there shouldn't be any bioavailable cadmium in there. Talk about our paint, obviously, but there is still cadmium in there. And so that does concern some people. I totally get that. And we'd still advise not to airbrush with them and that sort of thing, for instance. We do already have colours in there that sort of match pretty closely and they're just as strong, but they're considerably more expensive.
Yeah.
And, you know, what we wanted to do was try and find some that were at least only the same price, you know, even better if we can get them cheaper, but that still match that clarity, that brilliance, but also that opacity and intensity. And thus far it's been pretty hard. But, yeah, we've got them. We're just going through the whole testing regime most of them have come out. We've finished testing, so we're hoping early next year we'll have them out.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah, and a couple other little colours here and there that we've been working on that just sort of pop up because we find them and we find a supply of them. And they're not necessarily going to enlarge the spectrum. I've got a favourite little one that comes from one particular place in Russia, and it's black. Now, at the end of the day, we've already got four blacks, so maybe another one is maybe you don't have to race out and buy it because your whole spectrum is not complete without it. But you know, it has an interesting story, and those are the sort of things that I think if people have the option that want to use it, and for the reasons it was used a lot in iconic painting.
Oh, I love that. In a former life, when I was doing a master's thesis at Melbourne Uni on miraculous images of the Virgin Mary, I looked quite closely at pigments that were used in icons.
There
so
we
I
go.
Love
I
that.
Bet,
that
I
is amazing.
There we go. There we
yeah.
go.
Yeah. That's so why you should always tell the story, that. Stephen, because you never know. The person listening might have some equally weird backstory as well.
Well, seriously, I did a paper for the Royal Society on blues. And some of the stories were quite amazing, you know, of how they were developed over the years. Yeah. And I found out we're one of the only manufacturers that still produce real Prussian blue. We use the real Prussian blue rather than the blend.
Okay.
And in Dantherin, once again, not a big seller necessarily, but it's a colour that is there, you know.
Oh, it's a beautiful colour. So. It's a beautiful blue. Yeah.
Yeah,
oh, look,
yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing so many beautiful stories about your gorgeous paints and products that you make at Derebin Matisse. As I said, I'm a huge fan and it's a real honour to speak to you today and hear some of the backstory.
And thank you very much for having me. It's been great fun.
It's been great fun. Thanks a lot, Stephen. Catch you later.
Thanks.
Bye.
You can always see more of my art over at susannethercutt.com. And if you're interested in learning from me or checking out the podcast notes, you can find those over on susannethercuttstudio.com. I love hearing your comments and feedback, so feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you like what you're hearing, then why not snap a screenshot and share it in your Instagram stories? Be sure to tag me at susan.nethercutt so I can say hi. And if you've got a great idea for a future podcast episode or know someone who you think I should interview, then pop on over to susannethercottstudio.com/podcast, hit the button in the header image to shoot me an email. Catch you next time.